Hello, it's Norman Swan here from Radio National's Health Report. Sorry to interrupt your podcast. I'm just touting for business for the Health Report. We've got lots of stuff for you. And if you're interested in health and lifestyle, why not go there and see what's on offer? Just like everybody else, we're at the RN homepage.
Good morning to you. My name's Libby Price. Great to have your company on a country breakfast. From the glory days of managed investment schemes to their brutal demise, huge tracts of prime farming country were bought by investors wanting to avoid big tax bills by investing in plantation forests.
I think of vast amounts of blue gum trees on beautiful farming land, and it's upsetting to me. I think originally it was done to make a lot of money for someone, but now I see them being cut out and destroyed again, so it wasn't probably what they hoped it would be.
Converting the land back to farming's proving to be easier said than done. We'll also travel the country with our rural reporters, but before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Edwina Farley. Another week, another plant closure.
It's horrendous, the food processing and manufacturing business at the moment. Well, it has been for the last few years, really. But this week, vegetable processor Simplot Australia says two of its plants are likely to close. Director Terry O'Brien says the factories at Bathurst in New South Wales and Devonport in Tasmania simply aren't generating enough profit. Now, the Devonport plant employs 160 full-time staff and sustains most of Tasmania's processing vegetable growers. Mr. O'Brien says he'll try to keep the operations open, but the Bathurst plant might close as early as next year.
And essentially, it revolves around the fact that the vegetable business in Australia has been a chronic underperformer from a profit perspective for a long, long time. And the way the market's running at the moment and our reading of the prospects of the market for quite some time to come suggests that it's not going to get better. If anything, it's going to get worse.
It's just terrible, isn't it? What do vegetable growers say?
Well, it's ironic. They're kind of pointing to the National Food Plan, which was just released a couple of weeks ago by the Federal Agriculture Minister. They're saying that now comes too late to save Australia's food processors from shutting down. Andrew White from the grower group AusVeg says Australian food growers and processors are really struggling to compete and survive.
The National Food Plan that was released by the federal government outlines a range of ambitious goals for the Australian food production industry by 2025, but 2025 isn't going to cut it. We need to do something now. We need to start taking actions now, and really we do call on the federal government sincerely to urgently reevaluate the whole sector.
Well, they've been doing that with SBC, urging the government to bring in some sort of temporary tariff. Are there similar suggestions here?
There are, and look, the last thing, even Terry O'Brien from Simplot said, we don't want bailout packages, we don't want to go down the path of the car industry. Andrew Craigie from the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association says all these sort of offers of subsidies are meaningless. He says it's like putting band-aids on a festering sore. He thinks federal import legislation should be changed to stop cheap imported vegetables flooding in.
Just what it may need is a temporary quota put in until the Australian dollar adjusts back to where it should be, or we become more in tune with working in that sort of environment.
Coles is at it again. This time it was sort of all over before it really began.
It was a curious week, largely played out via social media, bizarrely, but Animals Australia partnered with Coles to sell a particular type of shopping bag which promoted getting rid of factory farming. Now, of course, this led to uproar in farming circles for Coles to align itself with what the farming circles say is an organisation that promotes being meat-free. And as a result, the shopping bags were withdrawn. Now, Animals Australia said that's the result of a vicious campaign by the National Farmers Federation, and it's very unhappy about the turn of events. Lisa Chalk from that organisation says a television campaign starting next week will replace the bags, which have now been pulled from Coles supermarkets.
This has actually only increased our determination to provide those animals with representation. We aren't taking a backward step. We're simply changing direction and changing tack. And that's why we're putting a national television advertising campaign to air this week that will show consumers what the National Farmers Federation has fought so hard to hide, and that is what happens to animals in these production production systems.
Well, it's hardly surprising farmers would be horrified by the campaign. Coles says it didn't push Animals Australia?
No, Robert Hadler from Coles says there was no pressure put on Animals Australia to withdraw the bags.
Animals Australia called Coles and suggested the approach, and we believe that that was the right thing to do, because clearly the debate about the ban on live cattle exports had overshadowed the good work that Coles and its farmer suppliers were doing on the sow stall free pork and to take out eggs from caged chickens.
Speaking of flying pigs, there are also pig brothers, pigs yeah. being filmed.
Well, yes, it was a fairly shocking discovery for the owners of a piggery at Young in New South Wales, who are now considering legal action against whoever placed hidden cameras in their pig sheds. The cameras were accidentally discovered under a Hessian bag in a false roof by a worker at Blantyre Farms. Part owner Edwina Beveridge believes the cameras are the work of animal activists trying to film pigs being mistreated.
Oh, we were mortified, you know, just so rattled to think that someone's been into our place, onto our farm, you know, putting in hidden cameras. It just makes you feel sick in the stomach. And I think some of our staff, I think, were probably more rattled than I was. Just an awful violation, really.
Now, this was a bolt from the blue. Victoria is the first state to sign up to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
Yes, it seems Premier Dennis Napthine is very keen to start ticking off some items on his to-do list. He's now secured his state's responsibilities for the plan's implementation. Essentially, it means that Victoria will receive $14 million over 3 years to develop projects to offset the volume of water needed to be recovered from irrigators and returned to the environment. Now, the Commonwealth is still waiting for New South Wales, South Australia and Queensland and the ACT to actually sign up to this Intergovernmental Agreement, or IGA. Victorian Water Minister Peter Walsh says no more water will be bought by the federal government from Victoria until 2016.
I'm not sure where the other states are up to. From Victoria's point of view, we've been negotiating for what we want from a Victorian point of view, and when we've achieved that, we've been prepared to sign up. We did that with the plan. We've now done that with the IGA.
Now, we've heard about fracking and coal seam gas. There's also something known as shale gas.
And apparently, Australia is sitting on a vast resource of it, but better regulation and lower infrastructure costs are going to be needed if we're going to develop a large-scale industry. Shale gas actually requires, it exists deeper than coal seam gas, and it usually requires fracking techniques to extract it. Of course, it provides one-third of the gas supply in the United States, and it is highly controversial there because of specific fracking methods. Australia has only one commercial well so far. Dr. Peter Cook from the Australian Council of Learned Academies says its report shows the industry must still overcome many hurdles.
Whilst the title is gold mine or environmental disaster, it's not going to be either of those. It will require great skill, persistence, capital and careful management of any impacts, transparent and effective regulation. Provided we have all these things in place and the right rocks, shale gas could be an important new energy option for Australia.
He does speak as if he would come from the Australian Council of Learned Academics.
I like, as long as we have the right rocks. That's right.
Now, dairy farmers have been complaining for a couple of years that the price they receive for milk is below the cost of production. They've had a bit of a boost.
They have, but they're still not happy. Australia's largest milk processor, Murray Goulburn, announced its highest ever opening price this week, but farmers are sort of saying, look, that's great, but it's still not enough. It's opening at about 42 cents per litre. Murray Goulburn's Robert Poole says a lot of farmers really just need the cash now.
It's been a very tough year. Opening has been brought forward by us because we've seen a lot of farmers in the last few months. There's no doubt that they wanted us to bring the announcement forward and make it a good one.
And this next story is one of those, I did not know that, about seaweed.
Do you like seaweed? I love seaweed.
I do.
It's delicious. Well, Victorian researchers are now investigating the potential to eat native Australian seaweed. Apparently, we have the most diverse range of seaweeds in the world. And, of course, it's very good for you. It's high in antioxidants and omega-3 fats and is a source of protein. Deakin University researcher Dr. Alicia Belgrove wants to know what Australian seaweeds taste the best.
when I was in Korea, in the supermarket, there's a whole kind of display of all these different seaweed chips. And they're basically using different kinds of seaweeds, frying them and, you know, coating them in different sorts of spices. And they're really fantastic beer snacks. But they're much better for you than your typical chips because they don't actually absorb the oil like a potato does.
Now, this next one really has to be seen to be believed, and I think it's no wonder people think there are pumas in Australia, the biggest cats I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is staggering. You have to check out the pictures online. The feral cat population across Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory has literally just gone crazy. Traditional owners have noticed a steep decline in local birds and other wildlife. The Waterkin Ranger Group has taken pictures of huge cats to try to leverage some federal money to monitor and kill them. Research manager Georgia Valance says the cats often exceed a metre in length and the amount of wildlife they eat is staggering.
One that was culled last year, for example, had the remains of two sugar gliders. It had, I believe, a velvet gecko, a bird of some sort, as well as some insects in there. So, I mean, that's one cat, one day.
Ugh.
I know. You'd be needing a cow-sized bell for those ones, wouldn't you?
You would think they'd get little things because you'd think that'd be cumbersome, but I suppose they're...
It's a really scary photo, isn't it? It puts you off camping.
It does. Actually, it didn't take much to put me off camping anyway. Edwina, thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Edwina Farley with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Today on The Science Show, a forum on climate. Can it be discussed without party politics?
There is something like 32 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide put into the atmosphere by mankind, and this amount is rising by about 3% per year.
And we contribute nearly 4.5% of that. Does it matter? What can be done? Join Nick Rowley, Herbert Hubbard, Leslie Hughes, Matthew England and Don Burke, free from his backyard, on The Science Show today at noon.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week we join volunteers in the Simpson Desert studying one of Australia's rarest trees. Meet a publican who swapped life in the Victorian Alps for the heat and dust of outback New South Wales, and the Weather Bureau's phasing out hydrogen balloon launches. We're on hand when the last balloon lifts off in Mildura, and we join Charlie McKillop on a cruise along Cobbold Gorge, an oasis in North Queensland.
It's quite a surreal feeling, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It's beautiful.
Have you encountered anything like this before?
Never. No, it's really, really interesting.
What about you, sir? What are your impressions of Cobbold Gorge?
Very, very impressed. It's very eerie. It's beautiful. It's spectacular. Everything. More than you could imagine.
Obviously so special, you have to whisper, exploring the beauty of Cobbold Gorge later in the program. But first to Central Australia, home to the rare and endangered Acacia puce.
All right, that one's at 2.9, I reckon.
They're out there, they've got their gardening gloves on and a very, very long tape measure, which they're trying to walk around in a perfect circle.
What we're doing, we've found the centre pole from where we're going to be measuring out 50 metres to essentially set up our little study area to go around and measure the heights and the girths of the stems or the trunks of the trees. And hopefully this will contribute to some information about how these trees respond to different climatic conditions.
Jimmy Cocking from the Arid Lands Environment Centre has organised a group of 11 volunteers to drive more than 4 hours to the edge of the Simpson Desert to measure and count a small group of trees. Hello, I'm Caddy Brain. And what we're looking at today is one of Australia's rarest trees. The Acacia puce exists only in 3 known areas of the Simpson Desert. 2 are in Queensland and the 3rd here at the Mac Clark Reserve, about 500 kilometres southeast of Alice Springs. and these trees couldn't look more out of place. On the bare Gibber Plain, they're the only upright thing, as far as the eye can see, in every direction. But as botanist Dr. Catherine Nano explains, that's not the only thing that's remarkable about the acacia puce.
This site and acacia puce itself is extremely important to the indigenous, the Southern Urunda people in particular. So pretty well every stand and certainly some individuals were part of a dreaming story. So it's always been really important to people. And then with pastoralism, I suppose the tree was treated as a resource. There not been much timber around, so people were starting to use it as fence posts and probably firewood too.
There's a huge variation in height, isn't there? How old would this one be and how do you measure their age?
Yeah, it's a good question. With things that are slow growing, it's always hard to know how old they are. So something that's this tall, around a little bit over a metre, is actually older than 35 years. So
almost like a Christmas tree, really, you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's a very interesting tree in that there's two forms. So with the younger saplings and the juveniles, I suppose you could describe it as a conifer-like form. So it's short and it's cylindrical. So once it hits about, certainly over 4 metres, that's when you start getting the tree branching, and then you get these lovely long casuarina-like phyllodes, and yeah, it completely changes form.
Beyond our little acacia puce here is a far older one, clearly. It must be, would that be about 10 metres?
That would be around 16 metres, that one, yeah.
So how old would this one be?
I can't imagine, but it seems like the upper limit is around 200 years. Certainly something like that would be, you know, 150 to 200 years old, yeah.
To call it a resilient plant, would that be an understatement? I mean, what is the annual rainfall for this area?
It's something like 150 mils yeah, per annum. So, yeah, it's just that classic thing of a desert tree putting all its effort into rare recruitment events. In between those big wet years, not much happens at all.
Getting a sense of how the population is going is essential. Dr. Simon Ward says while there's many threats, it's the kind of people power here on the ground that will be crucial in protecting threatened species into the future.
The population numbers of adults is probably pretty steady. It might be dropping as the older trees die off for whatever reason. The question is whether we've got the recruitment coming through of the younger ones to replace those odd adults that drop off. And I'm a bit startled here that you've got such relatively small, immature foliage trees, which are 35 years old. There might be, you know, 1,000 trees here, but because they're in such a small area, single climatic events could wipe them all out. It does make us concerned about them, and we have to consider them as a threatened species.
What do you think's the greatest threat that they're facing at the moment? Is it a single climatic event?
It's a single climatic event and very energetic cows which jump fences. So before they put up the fences, the largest problem for them was cattle cropping off the tops of the younger bushes which haven't made it to maturity yet, or rubbing up against the adults and damaging them that way. By putting up the fences and good fences, we've reduced that problem with cattle. So now it is those climatic events which may produce larger fires or big wind systems which take them out.
So does this trip give you heart in terms of the future of this population?
There's a couple of factors which give me heart. One is they're still here. The other is that we've got a group of volunteers who are interested. They seem to be enjoying it. They might be lying to me, but I don't believe they are. They're enthusiastic about this sort of work. They see the relevance of it and they want to be involved. And that is a really important thing for conservation across Australia, because I'm afraid it's got to the stage now where we can't leave this sort of work to the government and expecting them to be doing everything, because it's just not going to happen. It's got to be land managers, it's got to be done by communities, even if they're 4 hours' drive away.
The reaction from family and friends was initially, what the hell are you doing? But coming out here was all part of probably a long-term plan for us, which was, you know, to travel and be able to go into people's pubs wherever we went in Australia and know that we could run it, you know, especially remote places where people have trouble getting away or finding people who know how to run a pub.
And when the pub in question is in the tiny remote town of Tipperborough, hundreds of kilometres from anywhere, it's good to know you've got an experienced publican like Steve McDermott behind the bar. Hello, Cherie McDonald with you. In what's known locally as Corner Country, the bit on the map where the borders of Queensland, South Australia and New South Wales all come together. Tipperborough, it's a four-hour drive north of Broken Hill with a resident population of about 80. But this swells during the cooler months when the grey nomads and desert travellers hit the road looking for adventure. So just how different is it to live and work in the dusty outback when your last job was pulling beers in a pub on the way to the Victorian ski fields? Here's Steve again.
Honestly, you know, it's the same game, different place. The people you see out here are probably a little bit different. You know, you're seeing different sorts of tourists, big trip sort of tourists. The other pub down Victoria, the tourists were like day tripper tourists going to snowfields. But out here, their lifestyle's out here on the stations, you know, they've got stations versus farms. We've met some lovely people and, you know, they've been great.
There's another pub in town. There's two pubs in town, a town of about 80 people who live here. Is there enough people in town for two pubs?
Not living in town, but the whole town. I mean, Tipperborough really wholly survives on tourism and people coming and doing the outback tours, trips going through here. It's like an axis at Tipperborough. You can go all points of the compass. But yeah, no, not people in town, but the tourists, you know, the last official count was between 50 and 60,000 odd people come through this town a year. It's not lonely by any means. This is not, you know, you might be in the middle of nowhere, but this is not a lonely or quiet town. You know, there's a lot of people. So it's, you know, it's no big deal out here really, because there's a lot of people.
Now you mentioned the tourists and obviously relying upon tourists for your business. How have things gone when roads are cut and the weather's bad?
Well, you know, when it does rain out here, the roads will generally get closed. It shuts people out of town. It stops people touring, obviously. If they're looking at weather before they head out, it'll stop them and they possibly will go another direction so they won't come out to the corner country. This year alone, you know, it's probably been up to now, we're 4 months into this year, there's probably been four or five occasions where the truck has not come through on the day that it was due. You know, it's been held up for a day, up to 3-4 days, and that's, you know, that's so at the moment that's 1 day a month, and it can get more than that sometimes. Yeah, it becomes really hard.
I'd imagine the logistics, the approach to running the pub would be very different compared to there and to here.
In country Victoria, you know, things like food deliveries, we could get them pretty much every day of the working week. Out here, we get one delivery a week. If we've got a big function or something coming up, we've got to, you know, plan that 2 weeks ahead and have stock here on time, ready. Again, if it rains, you know, we have road closures. Trucks can't get in with our gear. You know, stuff can sit down in Broken Hill and sometimes even spoil because it's been so long. You know, they may not get through.
It's one thing to not be able to put a meal on the table, but if the pub runs dry, then that's probably not so good either.
Yeah, the old pub with no beer, eh? I'll tell you what, I learned early out here that you keep a fair bit of stock. You know, if the taps run dry, there's always stubbies. And it just, you know, they'll drink whatever's here when it comes down to it, so you feed them whatever you've got.
With the global financial crisis and cuts happening all over the place, you hear of people watching their pennies. Are you seeing that here in town?
As far as I'm concerned, it's been a good thing. It's stopped them going overseas and it's kept them in Australia and travelling around within Australia and made them get out to these remote areas. You know, they have a good look around their own country. We've had sort of reasonable sort of growth over the years since we've been here. Like I say, it's probably been good for us.
So country, remote, rural life is agreeing with you then?
Oh, absolutely. Be happy wherever I go, I'd reckon.
Tibooburra Republican Steve McDermott speaking with Sheree McDonald. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, we're cruising Cobbold Gorge and releasing the last weather balloon in Mildura.
3, 2, 1, blast off. And the balloon's aloft now. Yeah, strange moment. Last time we'll be doing this here at the Mildura Weather Office for, well, forever now. And after being involved in weather balloon launches for 27 years, it's one of those moments that probably shouldn't have a tear in the eye, but does feel a little bit nostalgic. And it's certainly the end of an era. And for the moment, at least, we've got a bright orange balloon disappearing into the sky and being pulled away from us.
With just the flick of a switch, Bureau of Meteorology forecaster Mark Wilger releases the final hydrogen weather balloon high into the skies above Mildura in northwest Victoria. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington, and it's the end of an era for weather forecasters in this district, and in fact around the country, as the Bureau slowly phases out balloon launches in favour of vertical pointing radars. The beauty of the new technology is that it can provide wind measurements up to 20,000 feet every 15 minutes, rather than just daily recordings with the balloon launches. That's great for accuracy and for weather forecasting, but I can't help thinking Mark Wilger is just a little bit sad to be waving goodbye to his last balloon.
Yeah, I think it certainly changed significantly. In the olden days, we'd be decked out in anti-flash gear, goggles, white gloves, anti-static straps on our boots, anything to avoid a static spark that might ignite the hydrogen that was used to fill the balloons. And so there was a strong connection between the weather observer and the balloon physically holding it in hand. And those releases could become quite dramatic in very strong winds too. You're sort of wrestling with the balloon and trying to avoid collisions with trees and buildings. So that side of things changed. But just through necessity and with safety considerations, hydrogen, a very potentially dangerous gas at least. So probably a decade or more ago, the Bureau introduced their own device, a remote balloon launcher, basically a black canvas enclosure that separates the observer from the balloon and allows us to launch it remotely, as we've done this morning, simply by the flick of a switch. So, times have changed, and don't necessarily miss the old days, especially in strong winds on Lord Howe Island when you're trying to get the balloon out the door. But for the best part, it's something that I'll genuinely miss.
Do you have any fond memories, I guess, maybe not so fond of days when it just didn't quite go right?
Oh, yes, had plenty of those. And, I think that the offshore islands, which serve up their fair share of intimidating weather, Willis Island in the Coral Sea, deep lows, cyclones, that sort of thing, trying to get your balloon away under those conditions. In fact, sometimes the winds were so strong that opening the balloon shed door, we had a balloon shed door on either side, so basically you could protect the balloon from the prevailing wind. But sometimes actually getting those doors moving, big heavy doors, big strong winds, generally corroded like all hell in those tropical maritime environments. And they were always interesting, but I still reckon the all-time best effort, or perhaps worst effort, was on Lord Howe, where four consecutive balloon releases pranged straight into the big Norfolk pines that were right outside the office. I gave up after that.
I guess we won't be having those troubles with the new technology.
No, it's so different, you know, and aesthetically it's just a really different thing that we're looking at. An array of 27 aerials just isn't quite the same look as a bright orange balloon going up into the clouds. But what it does allow us to do is monitor the upper winds on a continuous basis, and like all technological advances, provided they're for good, not evil, and they're basically improving the quality of forecasting, then we'll just have to go with it. And I guess that'll become the norm until we introduce something new. And I hope the next stage is kind of bright and colourful at least.
So what is it that we are collecting when those balloons go up, and how different will that be with this new technology?
Yeah, same result, different method of gathering the information. What we're chasing is upper wind data, and that relates to speed and direction. Those two components are very, very important for forecasting, absolutely crucial for aviation.
A lot of us, and particularly those on the farm, live by the Bureau website. They're checking the radar and they're checking forecasts. Yeah. So do you think that this new technology will just help make a more comprehensive product that's being delivered to people?
Yeah, I do. And it's probably the case with all these technological advances. It's one thing to be introducing them, but what they've got to do is ultimately improve the quality of the data and the data collection. So just in its simplest form, when you're putting up a balloon once a day, you're getting an hour worth of upper wind data. The weather's very dynamic, so it's coming and going. It's changing rapidly at times. And when you've got that data coming in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know that you've got your finger on the pulse quite literally all the time. And you can perhaps see the weather evolve in very, very fine detail, and that can only be beneficial to the forecasting process. And if we can make a 1, 3, 5% improvement in the quality of our forecast, got to be a good thing. So I'll have to live without life and weather balloons.
It's quite a surreal feeling, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It's beautiful.
Have you encountered anything like this before?
Never. No, it's really, really interesting.
What about you, sir? What are your impressions of Cobo Gorge?
Very, very impressed. It's very eerie, it's beautiful, it's spectacular, everything. More than you could imagine.
It's a hidden gem in North Queensland that many people simply don't know exists. In fact, even the owners of Robin Hood Station only discovered this geological wonder on their property about 18 years ago. G'day, I'm Charlie McKillop at Cobalt Gorge, about 90 kilometres south of Georgetown in Queensland's Gulf Country. These dramatic sheer walls of the gorge are carved out of about 1 kilometre of rugged sandstone formation. In some places it extends 30 metres high, narrowing to just a couple of metres at the base. It's a sight that really can only be appreciated from above, or, thanks to our purpose-built solar-powered boat, from within the gorge itself.
Let you hear the sounds of silence, nature's sounds of silence.
What sets it apart from other, you know, there's remarkable gorges all across the Australian landscape. What do you think makes this one special?
Well, I think one of the novelties is you can actually get on the boat and go all the way up and down. A lot of them you can't. You can just look from the top. So this makes it, I think, one of the most unique experiences as far as gorges go that I've been to anyway.
It's incredible just scooting along in this narrow boat, being able to almost touch both sides at the same time.
It is indeed. I mean, and not only that, but the silence of it. It just sort of absorb everything. It's a surreal experience, very relaxing, very peaceful.
You can really be here at one with nature, can't you?
Exactly, yes. It's just, and every metre that you go along, there's something different. It's really beautiful. The moss and the ferns, like the ferns back there, were totally different to what I've ever seen before. So it's just, yeah, to see the sides of the rock face and the formations, it's just, yeah, really lovely.
How would you describe these rock formations?
Breathtaking. I've never had the opportunity to really immerse myself in something like this. Like, I've never really become a part of it. I heard that it was beautiful, but I never thought it would be like this.
Back on shore, the beauty and serenity of the waterhole and surrounding country is not lost, even on those who work here.
Welcome to Moyles.
It's not a bad view you've got here, mate.
Oh, mate, there's abs of magic, isn't it? Hey, look at that. Flat as a pancake, crystal clear water, nature all around. Can't get it much better than this. My name's Jamie, and yeah, I'm one of the guides here. The main role here is really to educate the public and in the likes of what the gorge has got to offer, really from the nature point of view. We bring people down here and we take them on an extended journey. Sometimes we actually go right over into the rock area and talk a little bit about history. Some of the folk here that are buried out on the property go up and look a little bit of the Aboriginal aspect of things and talk about their roles in this region. And then we go up into the gorge and give people a perspective of what geology there is all around here and how the gorge has been produced and how nature's taken its course and giving us what we can see today.
It's not everyone that has an office like this and a backdrop like this for their day-to-day work. Do you ever get sick of rocking up to work?
No.
Never?
No one to think about that one? No. No, this is every single time that I've been down here. Sometimes you just don't want to get out of bed in the morning. You're a little bit tired, a little bit achy, but you get down here and you do this sort of stuff and it's just wonderful. Great opportunity is guiding and being able to share, and you must have a love for it. You must have a bit of a love for what you're doing, otherwise no point doing it.
I hope we don't miss the bus. Oh, that's right, you're driving
it. Not going anywhere.
It's a desire to share the natural wonder of the gorge and to protect its environmental and cultural values that drives the business owners, Simon and Gay Terry. It hasn't always been that way. The property was and still is a working cattle station, until 18 years ago when Simon and a few mates first stumbled upon the gorge.
The boys had a little tinny. They decided to explore the further reaches of a water hull, which we always knew about. And that afternoon we sort of ran out of daylight, but we managed to get halfway up the gorge. So we returned the next morning and ventured further up to the other end and found that it actually extended back further than we thought. So that's where it all started.
Now, I'm just wondering, Gay Terry, your husband comes home, tells you about this discovery, a seed's been planted. How enthusiastically did you embrace this idea that perhaps you should be running a tourist venture here rather than a cattle property?
Yeah, I guess it was the fear of the unknown, not knowing what was ahead. I'd always been on cattle properties. Simon and I were married in 95, so it was basically the start of a new life together and start of a new business. 18 years later, I don't know any different.
Are you surprised at the number of people that turn up here and have just got no idea about the oasis that awaits when they turn off the Gulf Development Road and head 90 kilometres off the beaten track?
Yes, there's a lot of people in awe, I guess, at what's here, a little oasis in the middle of nowhere. A lot say that's better than they expected, so that's good. They love the bush and what we're doing to protect our land.
The comments that and feedback we get is quite extraordinary. It really motivates us to do more. The more you involve yourself in the business and be around those people and get that positive feedback, the more it drives you on.
You still like to get out there and chase a few cattle around the paddock, though?
Oh, yeah, you've got to go and talk to the cows. They're vitally important as part of the process, and it's good to get back out there and swallow a bit of dust and be amongst the animals.
Simon Terry from Robin Hood Station in Queensland's Gulf Country, adding that report from Charlie McKillop on Cobbold Gorge. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Next, the aftermath of the failed managed investment schemes where tens of thousands of hectares of prime farming country was bought up for plantation timber.
On Sunday Extra with me, Jonathan Green, we asked, are you a racist? Are you sure about that? Good folk who'd consider themselves well above a racial slur can easily give racist offence. We talked that over with a special panel and we heard from Professor Joseph Nye on the qualities of political leadership. Our outsiders were Nick Cato, Richard Brooks and James Button. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.
From the glory days of managed investment schemes to their brutal demise, huge tracts of prime farming country were bought by investors wanting to avoid big tax bills by buying into plantation forests. Many rural communities hated seeing land being sold for mass plantings of trees. It meant there were fewer farmers and less income generated locally. Then the schemes went belly up, and it's proving to be easier said than done to return the land to farming. Laura Paul reports.
I think of vast amounts of blue gum trees on beautiful farming land, and it's upsetting to me. I think originally it was done to make a lot of money for someone, but now I see them being cut out and destroyed again, so it wasn't probably what they hoped it would be.
I've been speaking with people on the street in Skipton in Western Victoria. It's an area with high rainfall and high-value farming properties. Traditionally, this area was sheep country, but more and more farmers are now growing high-yielding wheat and canola crops. Further up the road at Beaufort, contractor Charles Pithy is sowing former blue gum plantation land with grain. At significant expense, the trees were ripped out with bulldozers, the stumps were mulched down, and the land was levelled. Now the air seeder is working its way up and down the paddock. It dodges a few logs that were left behind, a bit of a souvenir of the paddock's former use.
We're just finishing off the last of the canola sowing on a paddock that was cleared from blue gums 3 years ago. This is its third crop. It's had two crops of wheat. The first year was white wheat and red wheat last year. The yields in both years were similar. We got around the 4 tonnes to the hectare of wheat in both years.
Was there any penalty compared to non-blue gum land in the district?
No, we farm country that hasn't ever had blue gums in it, and in both those years the yields here were similar with the yields on those other paddocks.
Are there any signs as we look out across this paddock? Can you tell that it was blue gums?
Apart from the odd charred log or the root ball here and there, there's really, in a couple of weeks, once this crop gets up above those, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it's had blue gums in it or not. So it's just the odd log here and there that's floating around that need to be picked up over time. The last of the evidence of the blue gums.
The paddocks also need extra fertiliser. All the expenses add up. Charles Pithy is doing the work for an investment management company called Australian Agribusiness Group. It bought 6,000 hectares of blue gum land from an MIS company that went bust. Executive Chairman Marcus Elgin says the per hectare costs vary.
The actual cost of removing stumps once the trees have been removed can be as little as $800 a hectare, but that's not the end of the job. And the real job, once it's actually completed and then ready to go back into farmland, is somewhere in the order of $1,200 to $1,400 a hectare.
And when you've tried to sell land that you've removed the blue gums from, what has demand been like?
I think it's fair to say that the demand for land in general across nearly all of Australia is extremely poor, on the back of the supply of land being extremely high. And if you put that in context with a fair degree of scepticism and uncertainty from the buyers in relation to what ex blue gum land is like and what it can produce, then you can imagine that we weren't overly thrilled with the reaction to the sale of some of our non-core areas.
The huge tracts of former MIS land that's for sale has brought down land values. Across Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia, 20,000 hectares of former Timbercorp land is advertised. Collier's international real estate agent Tim Altschwager is trying to sell it. He wants to sell the property in one big lot, but will consider offers from individual farmers for smaller pieces.
Back in sort of, you know, late 90s, early 2000, there was a big demand for this sort of land. Timber companies were paying probably double what land value was at the time, and we're securing a lot of land because of that. But I think those prices have definitely come back to where the land is in a normal situation, and then I suppose if it does get reverted back to grazing or cropping, well, that sort of cost will come off the land value as well.
So the key to turning blue gum plantations back to agriculture is cheap land. AAG Executive Chairman Marcus Elgin.
It's like my iron law of travel. You take half as many clothes and take twice as much money. And in the process of remediating blue gum land, it's a bit like that. It takes longer and it costs more, and you need to be cognizant that there are a whole range of fringe costs that you may not have considered in the first place. So, you know, it's a bit like life. There are constantly new challenges and new problems thrown up, but if you work hard at it and you develop good systems and you work with good people, you come up with a pretty good result.
So you are making money out of it?
We wouldn't be doing it if we weren't making money out of it.
Is it fair to say that you've profited from the demise of managed investment schemes?
I don't believe that we've profited from the demise of managed investment schemes. I would argue that what we're doing is converting land into its highest and best use. We are repopulating that land with people and with full-time employees. We're taking a really serious look at the environmental aspects of that farmland, and we're trying to be good neighbours and good farmers on that land.
Marcus Elgin from the Australian Agribusiness Group. Now, if you've ever been laughed at for talking to your plants, you might want to tune into this story. Scientists in Western Australia have found that plants not only produce sound, they can also hear. And it may mean that one day sounds may be able to replace some types of farm fertilisers, believe it or not. Our reporter Flint Duxfield took a peek at how plants communicate.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger!
It might sound like the stuff of science fiction, but scientists are saying there's now good reason to think plants can hear.
It looks like plants are actually emitting their own sounds, and it looks like they're actually responding to particular frequencies.
Dr. Monica Galliano is a researcher at the University of Western Australia. She says plants communicate in far more ways than most people think.
They use light, obviously. They can detect light reflected and bouncing off different surfaces, including other plants. And they do the same with chemicals. and how plants can use chemical to warn each other of approaching attackers and predators. They can call for help when they can sort of defend themselves.
Plants can call for help?
Yes. So they can release chemicals that they attract beneficial insects, and those insects will eat the herbivores that might be attacking the plant.
If that isn't impressive enough, Dr. Galliano then decided to see what would happen if she completely cut off the plants from any kind of physical, chemical or light-based communication. She put chili and basil plants next to each other in separate boxes. And guess what? It seems they can still communicate.
What we are observing is that they emit these sounds, vibration, cracking, clicking, whatever you want to call them. We're suspecting, and it seems like the most logical, I guess, that is about something to do about growth. You know, the plant cells are really quite stiff. And for a plant to grow and the cell to extend, especially in the roots, they literally need to break the wall of the cell.
It's also possible the plants are communicating through electromagnetic pulses, but Dr. Galliano says it makes sense that plants would use sound to communicate.
Sound, as you know, travels really well, and it's cheap because it's mechanical energy. A chemical will require a lot of effort to produce the right quantity, to make sure that you got the right receptors on the other side to be detected and then to translate the signal and all of that. While sound, in a very small burst, you can produce a lot of energy and just like send it out, and it can travel really fast.
So what do plants actually talk about? Well, the first thing is whether they should even grow at all.
Because, as we know, they can't really move very fast, and they can't just uproot themselves and run away if they don't like their neighbour. But one thing that they can do is to start growing really fast and sort of trying to overtake them, because if you gain access to the light, the one below you that is the one sort of, you know, being shaded by you will be the one that have the worst deal. And we did observe that kind of behavior. We observed, differences in the rate in which these chili seeds were germinating. They needed to make a quick decision of, is it worth growing here or not? And if it is, I'm going to be growing next to someone that I don't really like. What is the best way to grow here?
So that kind of communication actually happens before the plant has even germinated, when it's actually in its seed format as well.
I guess it has to. And that's why it was really interesting with the basil study, which is the recent one. In that case, what we noticed is that the response was actually prior to actual growth. The seeds already somehow received information on who was there, and they, knowing that it's a basil, they decided that this is good news and let's go for it.
The research sounds, excuse the pun, impressive, but is it likely to have any useful applications? Dr. Galliano says one day we could be using sound as a fertiliser.
If you could, instead of, saying using pesticides or herbicides or fertilizer, you could use something in a way that is a bit more organic, knowing what the plants need in terms of whether it's, a particular electromagnetic field or a particular sound emitted at a particular frequency at a certain time of growth. And you can encourage all of the growing aspect of the plant just by doing that. I think that would be pretty nice.
The idea of fertilising plants with vibrations sounds a bit wacky, but some scientists in Italy have already done studies with wine grapes with some pretty impressive results.
They played different frequency to different plants just to see what would happen, and they followed the plants for like a long time. 7 years is a long time to follow plants and see if anything happens. And they didn't actually need to use any pesticide, and they didn't need to use any fertilizers for the plants to grow properly and be, healthy, because different frequency were supporting those aspects. But it could revolutionize the way in which we do agriculture, and it would be a much friendlier way for the environment.
Dr. Galliano says they could also use sound to detect how stressed plants are, say during drought.
When there is a drought, the water in the tree gets sucked away, and air bubbles are created within the trunk, and they make a lot of noise. I guess, who knows, maybe it could, the acoustics of the trees and the plants could be an interesting sort of pre-warning for us to deal with, before we lose our crop, before we lose our forest, and maybe to support them in other ways.
Dr. Monica Galliano from the University of Western Australia, speaking there to Flint Duxfield via Skype. Well, it takes a brave teenager in a rural town to stick up for a mate who's come out as being gay. But this is what 17-year-old South Australian Luke Sivoir has done, taking his own personal experience and using it as part of his group's presentation at the Haywire Youth Forum. Now, his group's idea to help break down the door when it comes to homophobia could be taken on by your town or community with the help of a $10,000 grant from the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal. Luke Sivoir spoke with Brooke Neindorf about the project.
There was a lot of issues that people were throwing around, and one that I was particularly concerned about was the homophobia group and trying to eradicate that from rural communities. And the reason I chose that is because a mate came out and, yeah, his close mates were there to support him and that sort of thing, and were there for him. And then when he actually announced it through social media, he did get ridiculed and people were just, you know, calling him names. He was physically and verbally abused. And, yeah, he was pretty tormented like that and didn't really like to see him like that. So, yeah, I just sort of do whatever I could to try and fix it.
What were you then able to bring to that group by having that experience?
Oh, well, some people, like a few mates in the group, were bisexual and gay. And I think it was just good to have the aspect of the straight person being able to stick up for the other people, like the gays and the bis and whatever. And, yeah, it was good just to be there for them and just have that aspect that not everyone who isn't gay or anything like that is against it. Like, some people actually support it.
Do you think there is too much people against gays, lesbians, transgender in regional and rural areas?
Yeah, I think so. Like, everyone I talk to, especially with some of the older generations where it was really forced, you know, it's wrong and it's not the way God intended it or whatever. Yeah, I think especially with them. But I think it's slowly starting to disappear and more people are starting to become more tolerant and accepting of their sexual preferences.
So what was the idea that your group came up with to present to the rest of the Haywire winners?
Pretty much it was just a family day where everyone would gather and have a barbecue, and it was called Breaking Down the Door Day, so it was just breaking down that metaphorical barrier between coming out of the closet, so to speak, and yeah, just be there and being there to encourage people not to fear gays or lesbians in that community and just accept them and slowly tolerate them.
What was the response from the audience after they heard your presentation?
Well, most people, not a lot of people knew what to say. I think a few people were sort of stunned by it, and that's sort of what we were trying to get rid of, because obviously they might have been homophobic or anything like that. And but we did have a few people that would ask questions and stuff, and one person actually stood up and commended me for being there and being the straight person standing up for him, and that was just an awesome experience, having everyone stand up and clap, so that was pretty cool.
What is your friend who you said you were sticking up for and had in the back of your mind as you took part in this group, what's been his response to what your group came up with?
Yeah, he's a best mate now. He's always there for me, and he's just a good mate. And, yeah, he's always someone I can talk to about anything, and, yeah, he's always there for me whenever I need him, so that's just good. I just wanted to repay the favour. Yeah, I think he'd be pretty keen for it. He'd be up for it, and he'd like to be there for the first Breaking Down the Door Day if there is one.
There is an opportunity for a Breaking Down the Door Day for a regional or rural town or area as part of the funding from the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal. Why would you encourage a town to get involved with applying for this funding?
It's just, I know, excluding people and discriminating against people because of their sexual preference is just dumb, in my opinion. It's not something that I believe should be in any community, especially something that's as close-knit as a rural community is. And, yeah, just discriminating people because of their sexual preference, just, I don't think it's fair. So I just think anyone who can get aboard and support it is just a great thing to do.
How do you feel being a part of this funding announcement that's been announced for Haywire and the different projects that were thought of at the forum?
I don't know, really. It's just me. I just live in a country town, never thought it'd be anything like this. But, yeah, it's just cool. Good feeling.
Haywire winner Luke Sivoir speaking with Brooke Neindorf. And that's a Country Breakfast for this week. Details of all our stories, rural news, photos, and how to get a podcast to the program are available on our website at abc.net.au/rural. Thanks for joining the Rural Team this morning, and a big thank you to our technical producer, Alex Stinson. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.
President Ahmadinejad's term of office is coming to an end, and Iran is about to get a new president. Like all political events in Iran, this election has to be understood in the context of the ongoing tension between its two main political institutions.
The history of the Islamic Republic has been a history of the tension between these two wings of the state, the Islamic bit and the Republican bit.
Understanding democracy, Iranian style. You can download this Rear Vision from the RN website.